Hello, and welcome to the NEXT plc half year results call for analysts. My name is Brica, and I'll be the operator for today. Today, we're going to be starting with a Q&A session, so to ask a question, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypads. Our first question comes from Charlie Muir-Sands of Exane BNP Paribas. Charlie, please go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much for taking my questions. I had a question about your outlook around sourcing. I think you flagged that on average, you think you'll see around a 2.5% ASP increase in the first half of next year. I just wondered whether that was enough to deliver flat bought-in margins year-over-year or rebuild margins, perhaps even back to 2019 levels, given you indicated you'd taken a little bit of a hit in the first half of this year. And then my second question is, I just wondered if you could give us any color around whether the customers you've been recruiting over the last couple of years are demographically particularly different from previously. Are you managing to recruit younger customers, for example?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Charlie. Both good questions. In terms of margin, we're anticipating that we will have the same margin target, so we're not looking at sacrificing any bought-in gross margin. What we won't do, and what we never do, is we never, if Vive overachieve in a given season, we don't then build in that overachievement into the following season. So we will be going back to the target that we had in 2019 and 2020, and building in neither any overachievement or underachievement in those years. And we think we do think that 2.5% is enough to pay for the underlying cost price increases. And that 2.5% comes from largely from the stock that we have visibility of, because we've already bought a great deal of the stock that we plan to sell, certainly in the first 3 months of next year, if not later. The second question is on demographics. There's no significant difference in the demographics that we're seeing in terms of the people that we are recruiting. You remember we went in last, I think 6 months ago, we went into the fact that we were seeing a general broadening of our customer base, and we haven't seen any change to that trend. We're still seeing that sort of broadening trend is continuing.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you. The next question comes from Adam Cochrane from Deutsche Bank. So Adam, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Good morning. Thank you. A couple of questions, if I may. When you're talking about the new capacity that's going to come through from Elmsall 3, given the size of that capacity increase, do you have to manage the utilization rate across the warehouses in order to stop any sort of profit impact from lower utilization? Is the first one. And then secondly, you again talked about commission rate cuts on the label business. Now, I think it's your sort of aim is to be the most profitable route to market. Do you get any feedback on that? Is that where you are now, or is there further investment that might be required? And then the final one was really, have you had any learnings from the Total platform, given the starting of operations and the further clients you've signed up? Thanks.
Yeah, okay. So starting off with the lower utilization on Elmsall 3, there's no particular piece of management that we have to do. We're not anticipating any operational inefficiencies from having the additional space. In fact, quite the reverse. What we'll do is we'll move as much production as we possibly can into the new space, because it's cheaper to pick, pack and dispatch from that space than it is from the old space. So it will, the empty space, if you like, will end up being in our existing warehouses rather than the future ones. But where we will get the inefficiency is obviously the rent for the entire half of that building. In fact, the entire building kicks in straight away, and half the rates for the part that we're using kick in. So what you will see is a step change in fixed costs, and it's unlikely that the percentage increase we get in sales that year will be as big as the percentage increase in fixed costs. Some of that fixed cost increase will be paid for by increased operational efficiency, but not all of it. So in year one, you would expect overall warehousing costs, netting off the efficiencies in the new warehouse versus the additional fixed costs, you would expect that we would see margin erosion, net margin erosion from warehousing. There will be a bigger percentage of sales in that first year. I mean, that's kind of always what you get. Basically, you get an increase in efficiency of your variable costs when you're at new production, but a decrease in the efficiency of your the leverage of your fixed costs. In terms of the commission rate and feedback from clients, we haven't had anyone say, thank you very much for being our most profitable route to market, but equally, no one has said to us, oh, no, you're not, which gives us encouragement. And in terms of the lessons learned from starting up Total Platform, as with all these things, we had planned lots of contingency into the systems and warehousing work for the various Total Platform projects we had. We took all of the work that people said they were going to need to do and then estimated that they would sort of like a domestic building project, and it's always going to be significantly more than that. And what I can say is that we used all of the contingency that we had in terms of time and a little bit more in terms of sort of systems and warehousing time. So it sort of, it wasn't in line with the estimates we got from the people who were building it, but it was in line with our own estimates, broadly in line with our own estimates in terms of costs and generally the projects in terms of costs came in slightly higher than the estimates we got, but in terms of timescales, were generally delivered on time.
Thank you.
Do you need to follow up on any of that? Is that okay?
No, that's brilliant. I think in terms of your 5-8% margin outlook on that, is have you had any confidence where you can come within that range? Because it makes, I suppose, quite a big difference in the longer term based on what you've seen, or early days.
Yeah, I think first of all, it is ultimately within our control, and that we're not going to do it for no margin. You know, we just won't sign the deals if the margin isn't where it needs to be. I think in general, our view is that the bigger the contract, the lower the margin we can take. So, you know, in general, small clients, where there's a relatively high fixed cost element to sort of setting it all up, will be at higher margins than the very big clients where we will accept lower margins. Good. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Next question, please.
The next question comes from John Stevenson of Peel Hunt. So, John, please go ahead when you're ready.
Thanks. Morning, Simon. Can you talk a little bit about how your view of customer lifetime value has changed over recent years? I don't know to the extent it's been driven by label. And is there a positive relationship between label and own brand spend? And then second question, just in terms of how you think about the cost of acquisition, is it just a case of getting a decent return on the first order, or are you willing to spend more to acquire, you know, certain types of customers or maybe sort of potential credit shoppers?
Yes, okay. So the first thing is, actually the second question answers the first. So we don't look at customer lifetime value as an abstract generality. We only really look at the concept of lifetime value in the context of how much it costs to recruit someone. And what we do is any advertising campaign that we run, all marketing campaigns have to have an appraisal in the same way that a new store has an appraisal, and we will look at the first order sales, second order sales of any given cohort and look at sort of how different cohorts recruited through different media and in different territories behave historically and assume that that's the way they're going to behave going forward. In general, because our return on advertising spend is we keep the returns very high, the first order tends to be enough to pay for the vast majority of our advertising. Where we take a view tends to be overseas, where we'll accept a longer payback, and that is because we're much more certain that the sales we're generating are incremental overseas. It's much less likely than the customers that we've recruited would have joined us anyway than it is in the UK, where we think only 30% of even the new recruitment advertising, only 30% of the customers who appear to be recruited through digital advertising are over and above what would have come to us naturally. We've written quite a lot about this in the report about our marketing. What we've seen over the last 5 years is as we've invested in better software and improved the relationships we have with key digital marketing suppliers and eliminated some of the inefficiencies in the supply chain in that business, we have seen much improved returns from digital advertising, and that's what is driving the increases that we're seeing at the moment and the increases we expect to make next year in digital advertising.
Okay, and when people have come in, the new customers have come in specifically, you know, attracting those sort of joint brand marketing efforts that you mentioned of Adidas and so on, how many of them sort of go on to buy next own brand stuff as well? Is there a positive relationship?
It's very early days, John. So the honest answer is that we haven't yet, because we only started it really 6 months ago. And, you know, to get a sort of a clear picture of, you know, lifetime value, you really need to be looking at 2-3 years. But the evidence we've got is that the customers we are recruiting on those brands are, or that the, when people are recruited to buy a specific brand, they do buy that brand, but a good proportion of them then go on to buy next product as well.
Okay, brilliant. Great. Thanks, Simon.
Thank you. Okay, next question, please.
We now have Anne Critchlow from Societe Generale. So, Anne, please go ahead. I've opened your line.
Good morning. Thank you. I've got two, please. First of all, are you seeing any trend away from the home category now? And what's your view on the sort of hybrid working from home that we might end up with? Do you think this category will be sort of raised permanently in terms of interest from consumers? And then secondly, on Next Total Platform, in March you gave us basically a sort of descending order of size of the different brands that you're working with, so Reef being the largest, down to sort of Child's Play and the new brand. Just wondered where Gap fits in with that in terms of size, please. Thank you.
Yeah, okay, thank you, Anne. So, trend for home. So first of all, no trend in a cyclical market is ever permanent. So we are expecting the extraordinary growth we've seen in home sales to subside as time moves forward. And we're already seeing evidence of that. So we're already seeing that home sales are not growing at anything like the pace they were 6 months ago. I think some of it's being driven by working from home, but the rest of it was being driven by just being at home. I also think that these things do create their own momentum in that it's not, in that the trend towards redecorating your home isn't, the more people who are redecorating their home, the more other people join in. It's like all trends, they're kind of a little bit catching. So I think there is momentum in this trend beyond the end of lockdown, but I think it will return to more normal levels over the next sort of 12 months. In terms of Total Platform, Gap is not as big as Reef because Victoria's Secret, because it doesn't have a strong retail element. We're only opening really 5 retail outlets for Gap in the UK, and they're going to be relatively small. There'll be one large flagship store, and the other will be 5 small concessions. So Gap would come just up below Victoria's Secret, but that is because of the lack of retail business through it.
Great, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next question, please.
The next question comes from Tony Charette from Panmure Gordon. So please go ahead, Tony.
Thank you very much. Yeah, John's asked for some of my questions. I just wondered if you could let us know what percentage of your online visits come from SEM, SEO and direct, please.
I don't have those numbers available to me at the moment, Tony. Apologies. We will get.
I'll dig them out, Tony, and I'll drop you that on an email later.
Okay. On a sort of more general question, you've got a huge amount of data analysts and stuff like that. Any particular insights into what we might expect in the future from their analysis at the moment in terms of the online stuff?
Yeah, the data scientists we employ are more employed in sort of in productionizing our advertising and advertising our online marketing. So where we are seeing the vast majority of the work done by our online sort of digital analysts is about improving the response of our advertising off-site and also the response to our content on-site. And we have I'm not sure this entirely answers your question, but I can't give you a sort of general insight into how the 8 million consumers that we've got on us are changing their behaviour as a whole, because there is no big trend there other than the sort of broadening of demographics that we've talked about in the past. But in terms of where we're making good progress is on the sort of personalisation of product display on our website, where we are seeing where we've developed new on-site marketing techniques that target people much more precisely on the homepage and the exit page, and we are seeing some good traction on that.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Next question, sorry.
We now have Simon Irwin of Credit Suisse. So, Simon, your line is open.
Morning, Simon, Amanda. I've got three for you. First one is your explanation of sales over the summer appears to be quite contracyclical and different to what we're seeing from other retailers. You know, and overall demand has been relatively weak, and a lot of retailers have blamed the lack of holidays and kind of reasons to buy product. So I was wondering why you think that you seem to have been a beneficiary of that trend rather than being penalised. Second question just is around online capacity prior to Elmsall 3 coming on. Is that going to constrain, you know, either the core online business or your ability to take on more total platform customers over the next couple of years until that comes through? And thirdly, as you move towards being a platform that isn't a marketplace that isn't a marketplace, as it were, do you think all of your third-party brands are going to be able to kind of meet your 48-hour deadlines and be able to kind of get the product to you fast enough to meet those service commitments?
Yeah. Okay. So in terms of sales over the Christmas, over the holiday period, I think that any difference that you'll see will be down to mix. So, for example, the fact that we are quite a big children's and home retailer is going to have a different effect on home to, say, someone who is a women's fashion provider, where things like holiday clothing, beachwear, sandals, all of those things are much more important. And those holiday-specific products, that overseas holiday-specific product, definitely did do worse in that period. But things like return to school, sort of warmer summer children's clothing and home in particular all did much better in that period than we would expect. So I think the difference between our performance and others is going to be down to mix more than anything else. In terms of constraints on warehousing, I don't think it will constrain our core business, but it will in terms of additional new clients, the total platform, we won't be able to accommodate their significantly more than we've already got within our own warehouse complex until we get to sort of towards the end of towards the end of 23. That doesn't mean that we can't take on any new total platform customers. So, for example, Victoria's Secret is not actually warehoused on that main site. We put that in a satellite warehouse. So I don't think it will completely preclude new customers, but it will mean that when we initially take them on, they won't be as efficient as they could be in terms of our cost efficiency as they would be were we to be able to get them to our main warehouse complex. And we will, I think, take a view on that as and when different opportunities come up as to whether we take sort of 6 months to 9 months of less efficient operation in order to win contracts. And then the final question was, I wrote it down, but I can't read my own writing.
Can you just repeat that question? Sorry.
Yes, it was just whether all third-party brands are able to meet the kind of service provisions that you want in order to get within the 48-hour window, or whether you've at the moment just been kind of cherry-picking some of the larger and more efficient operations.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I should say is that the vast majority can, because it, just so that we're absolutely clear on this, we're picking it up from their warehouse. They're not delivering it from us. So they've only got to get it to their warehouse door. If we pass them an order at Monday night, they don't need to get that order to us till the end of Tuesday. And they only need to get it to their warehouse door, not to... to our warehouses. And remember, and also remember, it doesn't come to us sort of with a customer name on it. They are just picking single units that are not packed singly for or by customer. So it's a relatively straightforward pick. And what I should say is that for the vast majority of our platform plus partners, it hasn't been that hasn't been a constraint. Where we've moved platform plus on fashion, on home. Home is the one area, and we have detailed this in the report, where we have got some direct dispatch to customers. So where we're talking about big ticket, large items that don't tend to consolidate with our own items anyway, we have been working with some home partners to direct dispatch that product to the customer. With those clients, what we're working towards is it will still go straight from their warehouse to the customer, but it will be injected into our two-man delivery fleet, and we're already a good way through converting a lot of the direct dispatch home clients into what we're calling direct dispatch through our network. And again, the advantage of that is it gives us the leverage that we have through better delivery costs. On the whole, we're getting better delivery costs than our smaller home suppliers, the best two-man rates. But it also means that we get control of the service from the moment the item leaves our warehouse, and we get to deal with returns and all that other good stuff, which means that we don't see a degradation of service. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, that's great. So the only real constraint for most brands is they have to have essentially a UK DC of some description.
Yeah, I mean, we are, there is one supplier that we're working with that has an overseas warehouse, and in that case we are taking a view on a slightly longer delay for the customers.
And with when you have masses of capacity with Elms Hall 3, would you consider holding stock on behalf of third party, particularly overseas based brands?
Well, in effect that's what Label does. A lot of the product that we sell on Label is commission stock that doesn't belong to us, it belongs to our partners. We sell it on commission. So in effect, that's what Label's already doing.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Sam. Next question, please.
We now have Michael Benedict of Berenberg. So Michael, please go ahead when you're ready.
Morning both, thanks very much for taking my question. Just one on supply chain disruption, please. I wondered if you could give any colour on any particular categories that are being impacted. And then in terms of your successful offsetting of that, are you able to quantify the increase in your online SKUs over the last couple of years, please?
Yes, I would actually detail the increase in online SKUs against 5 years ago in the report, and I think it was actually on one of the slides that I presented very quickly today, so it's in your pack. If you go back to the report that we produced 6 months ago, we actually gave a detailed chart which I think showed options over 5 years for each year, both for Label and Next.
Yes, so the Next options of the last 5 years are up 120%,
yeah.
55,000.
So, and then in terms of supply chain disruption, the area that we've seen the biggest impact is home large goods from the Far East. And there are two things going on there. First of all, is that the surge in demand meant that we had very little stock in the business, so that, you know, that was the area that needed the stock most. But because it is very shipping hungry, as you need a lot of shipping for a relatively small number of products, it was the area where we had the biggest delays. So the larger the item was, and the more likely it is to come from the Far East, the more disruption that we had. Other than that, there wasn't any particular category that suffered. It was more about territories. So China suffered because the big port in Yantian closed down for, I think, 3 weeks. And that led to, you know, that took a long time for that delay to work its way through the system. And then in countries like Bangladesh, there was some disruption from COVID of both ports and factories.
Very helpful. Thanks very much.
Okay, next question, please.
We now have Anubhav Malhotra from Liberum Capital. So, please go ahead.
Hi, Dean. I think part of my question has been answered, but I'll still ask it to see if you have any other views on it. So, just on the guidance for average selling price increases for 6% in home and 1% in fashion. I know you said it's a bit of a reflection on the cost pressures we are seeing on the shipping side, but do you think there is any reflection on the level of competition and what the competition is doing in terms of taking prices in fashion, that you are restricted in your ability to take price increases there? And the second one, on Next Finance business and the 20 million provision that still exists, and your bad debt, the provision levels are very close to what they were in 2008, but clearly the consumer finances at the moment are much better than what they were, and you're seeing that in the demand for online customers. So any particular reason why you're still going ahead with the provision? Thank you.
It's a good question. In terms of the supplier base, I mean, at the end of the day, we take a view on prices based on cost price rather than what's going on in the market, and we're certainly not seeing any cost pressures on fashion or home in terms of competitive pressure on pricing. So, downward pressure on pricing in the market. So that is not the reason for the differential. The reason for the differential is down to the difference in the cost of goods, and the vast majority of the difference in cost of goods is down to shipping costs, and shipping costs are just a much bigger percentage of home products than they are of clothing. So that difference is entirely down to input prices rather than market prices. In terms of the provision of 20 million, it's a discussion that we have had regularly. Our view is that we haven't yet seen the end of furlough. We haven't yet seen we don't yet know what the longer term effects of COVID will be, or the pandemic will be, in terms of things like employment. But I think you're right in that the signs are looking better than they were, and that provision is something that we will keep under constant review.
Thank you.
Okay, next question, please.
We now have Richard Chamberlain of RBC. So, Richard, I've opened your line.
Thank you. Morning, Simon. Two from me, please. Can you just touch on the margin on sales you're achieving through aggregators? Has that had much impact yet on the overseas margin? That's the first one. The second one's on beauty. Do you feel you've reached critical mass yet with the major brands, and I guess as a supplementary, do you have any plans to scale up your sort of store presence on the beauty side? Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So starting with the aggregators are working at. We work with aggregators on a lower margin, but not a ridiculously thin margin. Where we can't make our target margin on aggregator sales, we'll put prices up, and we're quite happy to trade in countries at different prices on aggregators than we are on our own site. So the margin is lower, but maybe high single digits rather than it's not sub 5%. So I don't think we're going to see a material impact. But you are correct that the bigger the 14% net or so that we make overseas will diminish the bigger the aggregators are as part of the pot. But equally, there's no investment required really to service that, because they're doing all the investment. So you would expect, sure. We're not concerned about making a low margin on a very low risk, low investment sale. Sure. But you are correct that we should see margins to diminish as the aggregated increase in size. Mm-hmm. Second thing is, in terms of critical mass on beauty, I don't know what critical mass on beauty is. No one's yet told us what brand by brand what that accounts for. So I'm not sure I can answer that question. In terms of retail expansion, I think it's very unlikely, on any of the evidence we've got at the moment, that we will open more stores at this point. I think that we are still, with COVID restrictions still in place and people still COVID nervous, if not COVID, COVID limited by. They're not limited by the law, they are limited by what they're prepared to do. And on the beauty stores, in terms of their effectiveness, a lot of the effectiveness is about the salespeople and the application of product to customers by sales staff to help them decide what they want to look or smell like. And that is very hard, even today. So we've yet to see very positive signs out of those retail stores. But equally, we don't have any plans to close any of them.
Okay, that's helpful. I mean, just on follow up on the beauty then, maybe to phrase it slightly differently, I mean, do you feel that there's still sort of gaps? I mean, obviously you've done a great job acquiring, and clearly the brands are more than happy now to come with Next, the Chanels and the Clarins of this world. But are there still a number of, you know, significant major brands that you feel that you could and should add to the beauty offer?
Yeah, we have got a list of brands that we would like, and I think that most people, I'm not going to say them because we are talking to a lot of them, and I don't want to in any way affect our discussions by naming any individual brand in public, but I think it's very clear which brands we haven't got that we would like. That said, we are very happy with the performance of the brands that we've got.
Sure. Okay. Thanks very much.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, next question, please.
Thank you. If you would like to ask any further questions, please press *1 on your telephone keypads now. And we now have a follow-up question from Charlie Muir-Sands from Exane BNP Paribas. So, Charlie, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. And thank you for the great amount of reassurance with respect to your own capacity for peak this year and the contingencies you can use. I just wondered if you could talk about whether you see any constraint around last mile delivery, you know, courier capacity this year, and also whether you're seeing any particular cost inflation from your carriers.
Yeah, I suppose on the inflation side, not yet, but we would only see that once a year anyway when we have our discussions with them about repricing. We have a pricing conversation with our suppliers once a year where within our contract, if various forms of inflation are passed through at different levels within our contract. So we wouldn't be seeing those yet anyway.
That's correct, yes.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is in terms of capacity. I've got to be careful. I don't want to give information away about other parties that it's not mine to give away. But at the moment, we're not seeing as I understand it, our courier companies are seeing no problem at all recruiting new couriers. So unlike some industries which are seeing a significant squeeze, our impression is that the courier industry is not one of those industries. And that actually, having come through the pandemic, it appears that there are quite a lot of people who want flexibility of that work. So we're not concerned about the availability of couriers at this point. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. And I'm sorry, and one other follow-up question is a completely different topic. I'm probably trying to compare apples and oranges, but I think 5-6 years ago when your credit customer base was shrinking, you used to talk about a churn rate of around 20% per year, i.e. sort of a retention rate of 80%. I appreciate that's the base, not of new recruits, but you're now talking about, you know, retention of circa 20% versus five, six years ago. In a bigger picture sense, is churn higher than it used to be, or you know, is the immediate pre-pandemic the picture?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. The answer is no. If you look at the individual type of customers that we're recruiting, we're not seeing any particular increase in churn. So if you look at a customer who's been with us for 5 years as a credit customer, the churn of those customers is no higher than it would have been 5 years ago. But there are two things that have changed. The first is that we have far more new customers, and new customers have always churned much, much faster than existing customers. So once someone has ordered twice or three times, they are much less likely to leave us than someone who's ordered once. So the churn rates you're seeing are sort of 18 to 30% in new customers is very normal. But the big difference of our customer base today from where it was 5 years ago is that we have a much higher participation of cash customers, and cash customers churn faster than credit customers. So our overall churn rate has increased, not as a result of individual customer types churning faster, but as a result of the change in the mix of our customer base away from credit into cash customers, and also recently the increase in new customers as a percentage of total customer base, both of which will increase our overall churn. But you shouldn't affect the economics of the business, because the appraisal we're using to recruit new customers are exactly the same, and their performance once we've recruited them, as we sort of tried to demonstrate in their presentation, doesn't appear to have changed either.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, John. Next question, please.
We now have Ben Hunt from Investec. So, Ben, please go ahead.
Good morning. Just adding on to those comments of churn that you were describing then, what should the impact of increasing the range and the SKU have been on churn? I mean, obviously it's going to bring in new customers, which potentially increases that, and then it can also retain them. So I'm just intrigued as to how you think that would have impacted churn as well, or any details on that.
Yes, I mean, I think you've said it all. It may bring in a customer who's less likely to stay with us because it's a customer that hasn't come with us specifically for Next, and therefore what our general ranges are less applicable than someone who's joined, who did join specifically for Next. And equally, the breadth of our range may increase retention because you're more likely to come back because there's something, you're more likely to find something that you like on our website. I think of those two factors, the second one is by far the most important. The vast majority of new customers, and when I say the vast majority, I'm talking, you know, much more than 90% of new customers, the first order will have at least one Next item in it. So there are very few people who come to our site and whose first order is a non-Next item. And to that extent, I'm not expecting any dramatic change in retention rates. What I think we have seen over the last 5 years is an increase in average order value for any given cohort of customers. And I think that is being driven by the extension of the ranges, both of our own product and, more importantly, of label and the new products that customers really didn't know that we... A lot of customers weren't aware of the fact that we had a very big home range, even sort of 4 or 5 years ago, awareness of home was relatively low online. And obviously new categories like beauty. We should increase the average amount of customer spends with us in a year. What effect it has on retention rates is too early to say.
Great, thanks. Very insightful.
Good. Okay, well, have we got any more questions? I think we've got a second round question. Is that right?
We have a follow-up question from Simon Irwin of Credit Suisse. So, Simon, I've opened your line. Please go ahead.
Hi. Just a couple of quick ones on costs. Firstly, has there been any reallocation of central costs between retail and online, given obviously the diametric direction of sales growth, and would you anticipate that happening next year? And secondly, obviously big improvement in terms of the cost metrics coming out of catalogues. What's the scale of the opportunity left in that area?
Yeah, okay. So in terms of the reallocation, we detailed this in the report, actually, so you can kind of, because you're all brilliant analysts, you can do in your heads where I can't do immediately in my head, which work out what percentage of our costs are actually allocated on that basis. But I think there was a £14 million swing in the first three months when we were shut between online and retail, and that was simply a question of reallocating the costs between the two businesses based on their relative sales. And those costs, and that's things like product, HR, finance, where it's, you know, impossible to say which side of the business those costs fall. We allocate them on just a pure turnover participation basis, and we will continue to reallocate them in that way going forward, which I hope answers that question.
Thank you. And in terms of the photography and catalogue?
Yeah, I think the gain we've detailed, really the gain is just financial, and we've detailed what that was. I think it's about 1.9%.
Yes, yeah, so 30 million in the year.
Yeah, so that's 30 million gain. I think as fast as we can, we will invest that in digital marketing. So we're not looking to maintain margins where they are because we've got that gain from photography. We would aim to redeploy that expenditure into profitable marketing, and our aim is to build up our digital marketing budget as and when we find profitable avenues to invest it. So I think you should see over time that margin gain reversing out as we find other profitable ways of investing that money.
But is there a further opportunity to say do a similar amount next year, say?
Oh no, it's gone. Sorry, we are not producing any catalogs
okay,
now.
So that,
yeah, that, that, that,
It's one off and done.
That pot is spent. Yeah, there's no more money to save there. Sorry. I didn't realize you asked. Apologies. Yeah, no, that's it.
Good stuff. All right, thank you very much.
Okay, next question, please.
We now have another follow-up from Anne Critchlow of Societe Generale. So, Anne, please go ahead when you're ready.
Thanks. As you've been going online for about 20 years now, or more than 20 years, I'm thinking the average number of orders placed per year must be quite high. So just wondering if you're prepared to give us a frequency number. Thank you.
No, we don't publish that information.
Okay, all right.
Sorry. Okay, and on that slightly disappointing answer, We've come to the end of our questions. Thank you very much for your time today. We actually have got through the presentation in record time, I think 52 minutes today, and the questions in record time. So we're either doing something very right or very wrong. Either way, thank you very much for your time this morning. And if you have any follow-up questions, Amanda will be available on telephone. Okay, that's it. Thank you very much, everyone.
Bye, everyone. Bye.